Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives, so please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning and happy Friday. And Friday is sometimes when we take time on this program to cover some of the news and topics that are very important during the week that we didn't necessarily have time with all of the breaking news to cover. And for this segment, if you haven't been paying attention to the utter hypocrisy and ridiculousness of the left, there is perhaps no better headline than how the left is treating the refugees from South Africa. And finding, as Matt Walsh from The Daily Wire put it, the left just found a type of refugee they actually hate, and it's because they are white. And so, interestingly, there was a breaking news headline a couple of days ago from religionnews.com that said this: the Episcopal Church has announced it will end its decades-old partnership with the government to resettle refugees, citing moral opposition to resettling white Africaners from South Africa who have been classified as refugees by the Trump administration. So what exactly is going on? Well, our good friend Jeremy Carl, who is an author and also fellow at the Claremont Institute, responded to that breaking news article and said, not for nothing did I do an entire chapter on anti-whiteness in the church in his book, The Unprotected Class, How Anti-White Racism is Tearing America Apart. So Jeremy Carl joins me now. Let's kind of set the stage with a little more context here, Jeremy, and where the debate is focused.
Yeah, well, you said it nicely. I mean, essentially what they've done is they've taken these Afrikaner refugees from South Africa, and the sort of violence and threats toward that community has actually been very well documented. It's just not been a thing that a lot of the sort of regime, quote-unquote, mainstream media in the U.S. has talked about. But this has been going on for some time, particularly on farms, but also in urban areas. What's happening is now the Episcopal Church, which is, as you noted, I mean, it's been participating in these refugee programs for decades. When you have a number of these refugees who have totally legitimate claims to be refugees, they're not all young men, coincidentally, they're families and the sorts of things that you would expect from actual refugees. This is sort of offensive to their moral calculus because, of course, you had in the past, now this is 35 years ago that this ended, but you had apartheid in South Africa, which was a racial system that was unjust in a different way. And somehow basically implicit in what's going on is that these Afrikaners, many of whom were not even born when apartheid was going on, somehow have inherited some moral stigma where they couldn't possibly be victims, they could only be oppressors. And that's really what's kind of going on and driving the Episcopal Church's actions here.
Well, and this is so fascinating that the Episcopal Church, which of course is very leftist now, and the Democrats are suggesting somehow that, you know, that every refugee is welcome in the United States except white people, even though, you know, these aren't Americans, obviously. And, you know, and so it literally seems so focused simply on race. And it's not even like the Western nation view of, you know, kind of the white settler that took over the indigenous population, or some of these other, you know, these other objections that the left has claimed to be anti-white previously. So what is their argument here for being opposed to these type of refugees? And it does seem to be just centered solely on whiteness.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically it. And I think it's also important for context to note that The Afrikaners have been in South Africa for 400 years, and in many cases they've actually been there longer than many of the Bantu groups. The Zulus sort of mostly came later. I mean, again, I'm oversimplifying some complex history, but in many cases they developed these farms from kind of from wilderness where they were existing. So you do have these double standards, and again, it's just the notion that if they're white, if they are Christian, and the Christianity and Reform Christianity in particular is a really important part of Afrikaner culture, but that somehow this is illegitimate, that the only thing we want to do is bring in Somali Muslims and dump 80,000 of them in Minneapolis, and I'm not really exaggerating when I say that about the area, but if we somehow have 59 white Afrikaners who share a religion and a lot of cultural background with America's historic majority population, that this is somehow deeply illegitimate and harmful and, makes us implicit in some racism in some way.
And with that history, I mean, let's kind of more broadly talk about, the subject of your book, which is how anti-white racism is tearing America apart, because I don't think we can necessarily isolate just, this one instance, but it also is perhaps an example of a broader problem in the United States that is so focused on anti-whiteness. And the left has a lot of different talking points for that. They have a lot of different justifications and rationale for that. But as far as what you cover in your book, what is the impetus for this, and why is that such a big focus for the left?
Sure, absolutely. And I do have, as you noted, an entire chapter of my book kind of devoted to anti-whiteness in the church. And it's literally an epidemic in these mainline churches, so-called, like the Episcopal Church, the Congregational Church, the Presbyterian Church USA. And you may not, if you belong to one of those churches, be seeing this in your congregation when you go to worship on Sunday. But at the denominational level, sort of the most hysterical sort of racial proclamations get proclaimed. You had absolute hysteria around George Floyd, et cetera. But even beyond that, and again, I write about this in the book, it's the evangelical church is not clear of this either. And Vodi Bakum, who also wrote a terrific book called Fault Lines, he's an African-American Southern Baptist pastor, really gets into, in even greater detail, the sort of anti-whiteness that has come in even to the evangelical church. And literally what it is, it's not just a kind of, oh, this is a side thing that's bad, but they're kind of doing good gospel. One of the things that I talk about in the book is that, and Bakum explains this at greater length in his book, is that this is literally a substitution for the and a substitution of the notion that we're all guilty with people. Certain people are guilty, and need to be saved because of their racism, rather than we all need to be saved because we're sinners. We get into this in much greater detail, but this is something that really strikes at the heart of the church.
Yeah, and you mentioned Vodi Bakum's book, which I've read. It's excellent, and he raises the point of cultural Marxism and this push by the left to redefine kind of original sin rather than in biblical terms, and that this is a common flaw to all of humankind and all of humanity and anthropology, and that human beings are made in the image of God, have inherent dignity and worth, and we're all sinners, and that is regardless of our immutable characteristics, including race. And the oppressor, of course, is sin. And when we look at our salvation, that can only happen through the saving work of Jesus Christ. And that understanding of original sin has to be contrasted to cultural Marxism, which would suggest that the sinners are implicit in systemic racism, in whiteness, and even if you, obviously no one chose to be born the race that they are, but then this is how even white babies are racist, because it's somehow part of the nature of man, and they have no real solution for saving from that type of oppression relationship. And so it's just that white people are therefore destined to always be oppressors, and we have to continue to apologize for that. And I say we because, of course, I'm white. But, you know, the white man has to continually apologize and make amends, even though there will never be amends that are good enough. And so it is a theology in a sense. And I think that people miss that sometimes in the broader context of looking at the anti-white movement in America specifically, but I think across Western culture.
No, that's exactly right. And again, I think you hit on the key point, and I kind of touched on it as well, but I just want to restate it because it's so important. I mean, this is a theology without a salvation, right? And it is a substitute theology for actual Christianity. It is not something, even though this exists throughout the mainline church, it's everywhere, but even in a lot of parts of the evangelical church, it is simply, it's not like, oh, well, this is a mistake that's existing alongside good Christianity. No, this is like, it's like you're worshiping the devil in addition to Jesus, right? Like, you just can't do it. It is totally incompatible, but unfortunately, it's become quite pervasive, and you're really seeing this, again, sort of most extremely in the case of the Episcopal Church here, but they're just kind of the fall guy for a much broader regime of anti-whiteness within the church that I talk about in the book, and you know, this is kind of the fruit of that.
And so, and the book is The Unprotected Class, How Anti-White Racism is Tearing America Apart, by my special guest this morning, Jeremy Carl. And you can get that, you know, Amazon, wherever books are sold, titled The Unprotected Class. And so what is the solution in terms of policy? Obviously, the church needs to be engaged and be speaking truth. And the more people that understand the differences between these theological perspectives, hopefully we will return to being a Christian nation. But absent that great revival happening in the short term, what are some policy solutions that you explore in the book to contravene and counter this false narrative?
Yeah, well, I think it's simply a question of, it's almost not a conservative liberal thing, so I hate to put this in terms of politics, but I'll just use it as a shorthand for conservative folks need to get involved at the denominational level, particularly in the mainline, actually, but also in the evangelical church. I mean, this stuff happens because there's not light shed on it. So sort of the leftists, the cultural Marxists, they are kind of in all these denominational meetings and other things that we don't typically like to go to. You know, we want to show up at church on Sunday and pray and, you know, meet with our friends and do all those things. But when we don't participate, we don't get a seat at the table. So there's really that. I think in some of these extreme cases, you need to look at maybe on a policy level the tax status of some of these entities if they're going to advocate for this type of racial politics, which kind of is in contravention of U.S. law in many cases, or the Constitution. There's all sorts of things, but I think in the church, you know, it's a little less. If you ask me in society broadly, I think the things that the Trump administration is doing broadly, just on surfacing this issue, which is something that folks like me had called for quite a while, but even I am kind of shocked by how much just surfacing the issue just causes our opponents to expose themselves. They have to not sort of hide behind these fancy words, but people understand now that, oh, refugee for them means not white and not Christian, right? Like, if you're white Christian, you're not in that world. So now it's very obvious what the left is doing. So that's great. On the federal level, we can push for that type of policy. But in the churches, I think we've got to take back these denominations. And there is no shortcut for that other than kind of praying and for good discernment and being involved.
Yeah, and I hope that as we're seeing now with the election of this new pope that seems to at least be more traditional in terms of theology, not nearly as woke, and we're seeing, you know, some of hopefully the revival in the evangelical Protestant align, then hopefully we can have churches really pay attention to this. And it just underscores for listeners why Christians have to be engaged in policy. But first of all, how we have to be engaged in the church. We have to have the knowledge of God before we can go out and impact the culture for Christ, which is part of the Great Commission. It's part of our calling. And Jeremy Carl, I really appreciate your time this morning and everything you do to impact policy with the truth. So again, the book is The Unprotected Class by Jeremy Carl. You can also follow him on X at Real Jeremy Carl, and we'll be right back with more.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back, and we've been talking this week about the Big Beautiful Bill, which will contain potentially some popular tax breaks, and there is this question of no tax on tips, and the Republicans' plan, as the New York Times suggests, to inject Trump into the tax code. That's how they are framing it. And, you know, there's been some question from representatives like Marlon Stutzman, who I had on earlier this week, Congressman Chip Roy, and others who are concerned about the lack of really addressing, you know, comprehensive spending cuts, but there is a lot of room still for negotiation. So where are we at specifically with the tax issues, cutting spending, and giving Americans more of our hard-earned dollars back, or maybe that we can just keep it and we don't have to give it to the federal government anyway? Let's welcome in Brandon Arnold, who is the vice president of the National Taxpayers Union. And overall, Brandon, what's your view on this big, beautiful bill? And then we'll kind of filter that down into how this applies to taxes.
The big, beautiful bill, it's a good start. I think we have a solid piece of legislation to work from. I would concur with Representatives Roy and Stutzman that I think there's more work to be done in terms of spending. We are facing a crisis when it comes to our national debt right now. We cannot morally or economically impose this kind of debt burden onto future generations. So I think we need to do more there to cut spending and get rid of some of the clutter in the tax code, like these green energy credits. I think we need to be more aggressive there. But I do think we've made a good first start in making permanent tax policy, making sure we're not seeing a $4.5 trillion tax hike that would absolutely wallop the economy and hurt small businesses, hurt American families just dramatically. So it's a great start. I'd like to see some more refinement and some more work to perfect this bill. We're never going to get, of course, to a perfect bill, but I think we can improve upon what is a very strong initial step here.
So so ideally, then, you know, what could Congress contemplate that would make this stronger?
The first thing I would do, these green energy credits, which I just referenced, these came about from the Biden administration, their big Inflation Reduction Act, the worst named piece of legislation in American history. You know, this phases out those credits. I would get rid of them immediately. I know that's a difficult thing to do politically because some companies have already started to utilize them. But the longer you let these credits linger, the more likely they are to survive in the long term, because you're going to find a sympathetic Congress or a sympathetic president down the road that allows them to continue, maybe even makes them permanent. So the sooner you can rip these out of the tax code, the more likely you're going to have a durable effect. And we're talking about, you know, possibly $1 trillion in savings for American taxpayers if we can get these out of the tax code as quickly as possible. That can be used for deficit reduction. That can be used to grow the economy with better tax policy. There's a lot of better things that we can do besides subsidizing electric vehicles for wealthy Californians.
Yeah, and I think the vast majority of Americans would agree with you on that. I'm speaking with Brandon Arnold, who's the vice president of the National Taxpayers Union. So where is Congress in all of this? Because it seems like, at least from all of the reports, that there's no great enthusiasm to actually have any kind of spending cuts. It's a lot of justifications of their own pet priorities, and it doesn't seem like there's a lot being done to actually fulfill the Trump mandate when it comes to taxes and some of these other priorities.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, everybody is in favor of spending reductions in the abstract. We all want to make the government smaller, particularly on the right side of the ledger. We all say, yeah, let's cut spending. Let's make the government smaller. But then when we get down to brass tacks and we talk about actual proposals to do so, then people get a little weak-kneed. And we're certainly seeing that in Medicaid. There's a lot of even Republican senators that are like, oh, maybe we shouldn't allow this maybe we should allow this money laundering system that states have set up to bilk the federal government out of billions of dollars. Maybe we should allow that to persist. Maybe we shouldn't crack down on the waste and fraud in Medicaid because it is helping certain folks out there, certain special interest groups, even though Medicaid is spending over $30 billion a year in improper payments, payments that shouldn't be going out the door. So that should just be the tip of the iceberg here. But it's really hard to cut spending, and that's unfortunately why we have a nearly $37 trillion national debt and growing, because it's tough to do that spade work.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right that everybody, at least on the conservative side, is for spending cuts in the abstract. But then when it comes actually down to it, then they're like, well, wait, don't cut this, don't cut that. And I mean, it seems almost like your household budget where, you know, in theory, yeah, you want to save a lot of money. But then when it's like, okay, are you going to cut back on, you know, some of your snacks? Are you going to cut back on, you know, some of these, like your Netflix account or your Disney Plus account? Oh, no, these are priorities, you know? So, I mean, even on like the micro level of just a family budget, you can see how the Republicans with their kind of pet items don't want to cut some of this spending. So where are we at, though, on the whole no tax on tips? I mean, this was a kind of a big, a little bit odd, I think, move that Trump campaigned on, maybe, you know, more to get the hourly worker to invest in his campaign. And yet a lot of people who were looking at this type of policy said, well, why should only tipped professions be able to keep 100% of their earnings? Why wouldn't this be structured a little differently so that everyone could benefit?
Yeah, and I totally agree with that. Obviously, we want to help working class Americans right now. But what we're talking about is a pretty narrow band of workers that actually collect tips in a significant way. About 8% of salaried work, I'm sorry, 8% of tips of hourly workers and about 4% of salaried workers get tips, a meaningful amount of tips, and would stand to really benefit from this policy. What I would like to see, you know, I just don't like the idea of giving a big tax cut to the server and the bartender in the restaurant, but not really a meaningful tax cut to the host or the dishwasher or the kid that sweeps the floors. You know, if we're going to provide tax relief, and I very much think that we should, I would much rather provide broad-based relief, because all those people in the restaurants are working their tails off, and they all deserve to have a lower tax burden as a result of that. So that's why I generally favor lower taxes across the board than targeted provisions like no tax on tips or no tax on overtime or some of these other more focused tax policies.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense to say, okay, you know, why are we just focused on some workers and not others? And it seems like that is potentially an issue. And so has the Trump administration really contemplated that, or Congress in at least the big, beautiful bill sense? Or, you know, was this more of just a campaign kind of tactic that isn't really being followed through on? Or, you know, where are we at in that conversation?
I think it's a super popular concept, and you can get why, because we all recognize that a lot of these folks are hustling and working their tails off and deserve some tax relief. So it's really popular. So I think that's why it's kept afloat here, and it almost certainly will be part of this bill. But yeah, I think the concern, of course, is to have equity across different professions. And the other concern here is to make sure that provisions like this aren't gamed, because people could very easily reclassify non-tipped income as tipped income. People mm-hmm. could game the system on the overtime front as well. So it's really going to fall upon the IRS, an agency that we all know is completely off the rails in so many different ways. It's going to fall on the IRS to make sure that people aren't gaming the system and aren't taking advantage of these provisions to cut their taxes in an unethical or even illegal manner.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense as well. And I'm speaking with Brandon Arnold, who is the vice president of the National Taxpayers Union. And another promise that Trump made during the campaign was to look at eliminating, or at least severely reducing, but potentially eliminating the federal income tax. Obviously, there are some potential 16th Amendment issues there. And certainly, I don't think he could do that just by executive fiat, but this would necessitate congressional involvement. It doesn't seem like they're super willing to end a lot of their revenue there for the reasons we've already discussed. But in theory, what would be the best way that the Trump administration and Congress, if they wanted to, go about actually eliminating federal income tax? And are we going to potentially see that happen?
I think that's extremely unlikely. And listen, I want much lower taxes. Don't get me wrong here. But the first step in the process before you go about repealing the income tax or cutting taxes in general has to be addressing the spending side of the ledger, because otherwise all you're going to do is have massive deficits. We already have massive deficits, but you're going to supersize the $2 trillion deficits and make them $4 or $5 trillion deficits, and that would be economic disaster. So the first thing that you need to do is cut spending in a very, very significant fashion. And then you can talk about having that fiscal space where you're not running all this red ink to talk about maybe eliminating or scaling back the income tax. But I do think that is a bit of a pipe dream. The only way you could really generate sufficient revenue to keep the government operating would be something like a national sales tax, or maybe a VAT, a value-added tax, which a lot of European countries rely upon. So there'd be a huge disruption there, and I don't think that is politically feasible. I think what is more likely is to move in the direction that we did in 2017 and are hopefully doing now, and that is simplifying the tax code, lowering rates, making the tax burden much, much less significant on American families.
And all of that, it seems to be more reasonable and rational. And so where should American voters, I mean, as we're kind of sitting here just waiting for Congress and Trump to do all of these things, we're also looking at the state of the economy. There's a lot of concern, even though the tariff and trade war seem to be going reasonably well, even more than they were perhaps a month ago. But where should we be spending our energy and time and focus on some of these issues instead of maybe just sitting back and kind of waiting?
Yeah, I think it's much easier to cut taxes than it is to cut spending, as we touched on earlier. And the people that are trying to cut spending, you mentioned a couple of them, Chip Roy and Marlon Stutzman. There's a hardworking band of warriors out there in the House and to some extent in the Senate trying to cut spending. They're in an uphill battle. They need the support of their constituents. They need people out there steeling their spine and making sure that they can be successful in this effort. If we can cut spending in a significant fashion, then all of the tax policies, the pro-growth tax policies that are absolutely critical, become a lot easier because we have that fiscal space. So helping those members, giving them the support that they need, politically speaking, saying nice things about them, not beating the snot out of them when they do town hall meetings, which we've seen far too often, those kinds of things are absolutely invaluable to changing the dialogue that's taking place in Washington right now.
Yeah, and changing that dialogue is no easy task. And so overall, in just the last few minutes I have with you, Brandon Arnold, and appreciate your time here. You know, we touched a little bit on, or at least just mentioned, trade, the trade negotiations and the tariff issues and all of that. How ultimately does that impact the economy and then kind of fold into this whole conversation on taxes?
Yeah, we have a long way to go on the trade front, and it's good to see some progress being made with the UK and with China. We got a long way to go because, you know, right now the economic model suggests that the harmful impacts of the trade war as it stands now could counteract entirely the benefits of the tax bill that's moving. You know, these are tariffs, these are taxes that impact workers, they impact businesses, they make it harder for us to manufacture things, it makes it harder for farmers to fertilize their crops, to buy farm machinery and so forth. So I'm a big fan of getting to zero tariffs. I think the president has said he wants to do that. Let's get these negotiations moving along as quickly as possible. Let's create good deals that open up markets for our manufacturers and farmers and drive down the cost for consumers here. The quicker we can do that, the more success we're going to have as a country and the more economic prosperity we're going to see.
And so in your view, is Trump doing the best thing? You know, the right thing may be a matter of kind of time and waiting to see, but is he doing the best thing currently overall with some of these negotiations?
Well, my preference would be to pause all the tariffs across the board in their entirety while we hash out these deals, because as long as some of those tariffs exist and they're in a much smaller fashion than originally announced, it's kind of like driving the car with a parking brake on. Yeah, you can still do it, but it's going to go a little bit slower, and it's going to cause some automotive problems. If we can suspend these and then craft those deals, I think are going to be more long-term, more durable policies that are going to open up those markets for our businesses. I think that would be the best way to proceed. So I would change things a little bit. And, the sooner we can get these trade deals locked in, though, and completed, the better off our economy is going to be and the better off consumers are going to be.
Yeah, absolutely. Well said. And where are the states in all of this as well? I mean, there's been obviously a national conversation, but it's definitely state level. In my home state of Florida, with Governor DeSantis and trying to eliminate property taxes for Floridians, that would help us specifically. But there's a lot that the individual states can do, even if Congress doesn't act to cut spending, and there's not really a lot of relief on the federal level. How much is state involvement important?
Yeah, it's absolutely huge. And what you're seeing DeSantis doing, much to the chagrin of New York and New Jersey and other states, is create good tax and spending policies that have attracted millions of people to move to their state. Florida is now bigger than New York. That wasn't the case years ago. And it's because he is not just creating good tax policy and eliminating the property tax, which is a beautiful thing to do, but he's also spending on a per-person basis about half of what states like New Jersey and New York are spending. That's absolutely critical. When you get that spending down, it gives you that ability to enact really good tax policy. He's preserving, the quality of services that the government is providing, yet doing so at a much more efficient level, much more efficient cost. That is absolutely brilliant, and that is the growth model that Florida, Texas, North Carolina, other states have really set the mark for.
Well, I hope the Florida legislature is paying attention to you and others that are telling them that actually Governor DeSantis's plan is good, regardless of all of the political back and forth on the state level. But we're already out of time. Brandon Arnold, Vice President of the National Taxpayers Union, really appreciate your insights. And this is, an ongoing conversation that I think conservatives need to be paying attention to and demanding from Congress especially, but also in the state. So we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. When a woman experiences an unplanned pregnancy, she often feels alone and afraid. So many times, her first response is to seek out an abortion. But because of the generosity of listeners like you, that search may lead her to a Preborn Network clinic. Preborn offers God's love and compassion to hurting women and then provides a free ultrasound to introduce them to the life growing inside her. This combination brings the ultimate miracle of life to life and doubles a baby's chance at life, which is why Preborn saw over 67,000 babies rescued last year alone. Meet Maddie. Maddie was in a tough situation as she wasn't sure who the father of her child was. But after receiving counseling, prayer, and a free ultrasound at a Preborn Network clinic, everything changed. Maddie discovered she had twins and found the strength she needed to choose life. Your tax-deductible donation of $28 sponsors one ultrasound. How many babies can you save? Please donate your best gift today. Just dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or go to preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And one of the issues that I find most fascinating, especially for younger people today who are looking at, the America First agenda and some of these things, is why should America support Israel? And what is the historicity of understanding Israel's claim to the land and the current conflict in the Middle East? And I mean, this goes all the way back to Genesis 11, and we see the historical truth and fact of the Bible, and a lot of, I think, policy and politics among conservatives is really missing the piece of the biblical worldview, not just from a faith-based perspective, but actually historical fact. And there's a great brand new book out that is titled When the Stones Speak, and the Remarkable Discovery of the City of David and What Israel's Enemies Don't Want You to Know. So this is by Doran Spielman, and this is the untold story of the rediscovery of the ancient city of David in Jerusalem and powerful evidence that proves the Jewish people's historical and indigenous connection to the Holy Land. So author Doran Spielman joins me now, and this is really fascinating and I think so timely just in terms of American history, our relationship with Israel, but overall just this continual progression of showing that historical evidence always proves the Bible correct.
Absolutely. Jenna, it is such a pleasure to be with you and with you and with your audience who understands the truth and is looking for the truth.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, when we're talking about the discovery of the city of David, when we're talking about the refounding of Israel in 1948 and how the Jewish people have still faced, you know, anti-Semitism, hostility, but this is the fulfillment of prophecies. What does the discovery or rediscovery of the city of David show in terms of the truth of Genesis 11 and the Abrahamic covenant of Israel's right to the land?
It's the foundation of our belief. And when I say foundation, I don't mean that as an allegory. It is actually the physical foundation to our belief. You know, what's amazing, Jenna, is for 2,000 years, people thought they knew where the old city of Jerusalem was. It's inside those walls, those beautiful walls. And, you know, we would walk around and see a lot of incredible things, but there weren't things from the Bible itself until about 140 years ago. An explorer came to Israel looking for the actual Ark of the Covenant, speaking about holiness. You know, the original Indiana Jones, his name was Captain Charles Warren. And he wanders outside the walls down a valley and sees a spring of water. And he drinks from the water and he sees the waters flowing into the mountain. So he walks in the mountains like something right out of a movie with his flashlight, with his torch, his lantern. And after around 50 feet over his head, he sees a shaft, he climbs up, and he finds an entire underground city, the actual city of Jerusalem from the Bible, which was founded by King David, is underneath this mountain. And I was involved in this excavation over the last 22 years. And what happens is when you dig in the city of David, we've had more than 23 teams, Jews, Christians, even Muslims, the stuff that you pull out is written in ancient Hebrew and actually has names on it from the Bible. So, for example, the prophet Jeremiah, who doesn't know the prophet Jeremiah, right? He's the champion that God cares about the orphans and the widows. And he reaches out to every single person in their sorrow. They know that they have these prophecies. One day, the archaeologist, Dr. Elat Mazar, reaches in the ground and she finds a clay seal that was stamped by someone's signet ring 2,600 years ago. And the name on that seal is Jehuchal, the son of Shlemiah, who is the person in the Bible in Jeremiah 36, 37, and 38 that tried to kill the prophet Jeremiah. Jeremiah survives, but you actually have, when I say foundation, a name from the Holy Scriptures that we all connect to, found in the ground. And this is only one of hundreds of examples. So when people walk around the world today, and like you said, we're being bombarded by people who want to convince us the Bible isn't true, my book, When the Stones Speak, it's a roadmap that brings us directly back to that truth.
Wow. And this is incredible. I mean, this just is further proof of the point that that science and discovery and history supports the truth of the Word of God, and that this isn't just merely a belief system, it's rooted in historical fact, and that these discoveries continue to evidence that. And so what does this discovery mean in terms of the historicity of the Bible and where we're at today in public policy?
So people have faith. And, you know, it's incredible if you have faith. We all have faith. We believe in a God that, you know, we can't necessarily see. But we know that there's something, a higher power controlling our lives. But when you come to the city of David, it's not only faith, it's also fact. You're dealing with facts underneath the ground. And therefore, people, they could be kids, they could be relatives. I've had secular Jews and Christians that come to the city of David. And when they're when they're confronted by the facts, and I just told you just one of them, basically what we do is we open up the Bible and walk around the site. When they see that, their hearts open up, and they began to understand that we are all living within a divine world. And that is the power of the city of David. Now, geopolitically, what does this mean? And this is critical for all of your listeners, from whatever their background are, whether they're Christians or Jews and simply Americans. So first of all, our foundation is the Bible, right? The founding fathers of America crossed the sea to come to America, and they saw themselves like the ancient Israelites crossing the Red Sea. They lived out a biblical journey, the founding of America. Well, today, if you turn on the TV and you look at what Hamas are teaching those kids in Gaza, they're teaching those kids in Gaza that Muhammad was the first person in Jerusalem. He's the only prophet in Jerusalem. There never was Jewish history. As a matter of fact, I quote, the Mufti of Jerusalem, Ikrim Asabri, he teaches this to Muslims and goes in all the classrooms, not only in Israel, but throughout the world. Any stone you uncover in Jerusalem, not a single one of them has an ancient Jewish marking. Even Mahmoud Abbas 3 weeks ago said the temple was in Yemen if it had all existed. So they have created a history, Jenna, that simply erases our biblical history. And it's not only in the mindset of those Hamas fighters who stormed into Israel in their delirium. It's also you hear this on campus. All of your listeners, they have children going to campus, and whether they are Jews or Christians supporting Israel, they see it on our kids. See it on campus. They're confronted by people saying, no, those are colonialists. Those are imposters. Well, when you read my book, When the Stones Speak, what it does is it grounds our faith in faith and also in logic and creates a sense of security for our children. That's why it's such an important read to buy into read and then to actually share, because this is the story of the founding of America. And this is the same story that our enemies don't want us to know. So we know we have to know it and share it.
Wow. And that's just such an incredible history. And I think we have to have that application as well, to not just say, okay, well, you know, this may be interesting from a historical perspective, but then we lose the connection to today. And so where can we be focused on, you know, teaching the next generation why all of this matters, and to say, okay, you know, we may have America First policy, but part of being America First is supporting Israel by understanding their claim to the land, by understanding this history and supporting the truth of the promises of God. And, you know, we tend to, I think, try to frame our support for Israel merely as a salvific kind of issue and say, well, you know, they're God's chosen people and all of that, kind of, you know, negating the finished work on the cross a little bit to say, you know, the Gentiles are grafted in, all of these things. To me, it's a lot more about understanding that God's covenants are eternal and that this really matters from a historical perspective, but it does impact policy. So how would you say that we need to frame this for young people who are very engaged in American politics to understand why this matters from a faith-based perspective, but then putting that into policy overall?
Absolutely. First of all, it's a phenomenal question, and I'll phrase it like, I'll start in the negative. If what they are saying about Jewish history and the Israelites, as I say in the book, denying our history, then it basically denies Christianity, and it denies America. And if we love both our faith and we love America, the first thing we have to be able to do is to stand up and defend it. And for that, we need knowledge, which is why I wrote the book. It's important to read my book. It's important to read the Bible. It's important to not only live these things, Jenna, it's important that our young generation is able to speak about them with pride. What this basically does and what Israel does for America is it gives America a real sense that its founding was divine, because America and Israel share such values. We share such values. The Liberty Bell is inscribed, let liberty be proclaimed throughout the land. It's right from the Bible. And justice, tzedek tzedek tirdof, you shall follow justice and make justice. We cannot exist in the United States of America today in a changing world unless we know to reach deep and grab onto our faith and understand the whole reason we're here is because America has a higher purpose. And we can see in America today, that's the challenge. There are those who think, no, there's no higher purpose. There's no boundaries. You know, people can be whatever they choose. They can choose everything. It doesn't matter the way you were born. No, The Bible is our foundation. And while countries come and go, we know that the Bible has been there for all of us. And that's why the policy of the United States, of course, America has its own interests in mind. Israel is in America's interest because we contain the foundations of the faith that America exists on. And that is really the key. On a practical level, of course, Israel's a true ally. But, you know, why are we an ally? Why, you know, are we more of an ally than Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Syria and all these other places? The reason we're an ally is at the end of the day, you know, God forbid we get another less friendly president that comes in the future and tries to unwind these things. The one country that will never leave America's side is Israel because we share the same values. And that is why this is so important. You reach down beneath the ground and you listen to the stones speak. I call the book When the Stones Speak. Because if you listen to those stones in the bedrock of Jerusalem, what you hear is your identity. And we have to embolden this young generation. Know your identity, stand proud, defend it, and share it with the rest of the world.
So well said. And I'm speaking to Doran Spielman, whose book, When the Stones Speak, is out now on Amazon and wherever books are sold. And I think that's such a crucially important point that while we can and should be America first, be very patriotic and be interested in our country and our nation, the reason that we are America first ultimately is because we are foundationally Christians first. And we believe in the authority and the truth of the Word of God, which is unchanging. And as you said, nations come and go and kings and kingdoms will all pass away. But one thing remains, as the old hymn says, the truth of the person of God. And so we have to take all of this in context and understand how our nation ultimately can and should benefit the kingdom of God while having sovereignty, borders, policy, all of these things that go into the civil government and the nations that God himself has established. And if we divorce ourselves from, or decouple perhaps is a better term, civil government from church, and we buy into this false notion of total separation of church and state, and that the state is somehow secular, that rather than just a separate jurisdiction from the church, as Thomas Jefferson said in his letter to the Danbury Baptist, which was the right call, and then of course the Supreme Court has reinvented that and has really perverted that, frankly. But we can't ultimately be America first if we don't understand being Christ first and our identity in the truth of the gospel of Christ. And so if there's, you know, one big takeaway message from this book, When the Stones Speak, that you want readers to take away, what would it be?
Reach deep. Reach down deep inside of yourselves. We live in an age of distraction, of cell phones and beeps and tweets and everything else along the day. Take a breath, sit back, and think about why we're here. What is the purpose of our life, and what is our purpose as Americans? Do we want to be, you just said it so well, like the other nations of the world? I mean, do we really want to be like the Europeans that are being erased off the face of the map? Do we want to be people living in Afghanistan? No, we live in a country that is a light unto the nations because in God we trust. And when you read this book, what it does is it brings this imagined ropes that tie that theory all the way down to the bedrock of Jerusalem. We need something to hang on to. Read the book, buy it, read it, and share it, and come to Jerusalem and feel it. And then we'll know with absolute pride and a big smile on our face that we're all walking in the path of the truth.
And so well said. And we do need to walk in light of the truth and the gospel of Christ. And it's such an important point that I can't underscore enough, that it's not just about policy and politics. It's understanding the full counsel of God. And I think that books like this are incredibly helpful to underscore that point and to suggest that when we understand the full counsel of God in the history, that it continues to show the truth of the full counsel of God. Because so many people, Doran, think of the Bible as just, you know, this kind of, this kind of fortune cookie kind of, you know, well, this is wisdom that you can take or leave or whatever. And they don't necessarily think of it as proving the theological construct and the truth of the Christian life for that is necessary for our good. And there's so much more I could talk with you about. We're already out of time, but I really appreciate it. You can follow Doran Spielman on X, and his book is When the Stones Speak. You can get that on Amazon, wherever books are sold. Have a wonderful weekend. And as always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net. Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.